This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Millions of Americans who exercise enjoy the benefits of indoor gyms, but numbers of fitness enthusiasts have for decades lifted, flexed, and dazzled in the California sun. Last summer, Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder met some of the bronzed and brawny weightlifters of Muscle Beach in Southern California, and he filed this report.
Under yet another sunny Southern California sky, about 500 people gather at Muscle Beach, the world-famous outdoor gym lying just off the boardwalk in Venice, California. They're here to watch the Venice Classic, Muscle Beach's annual amateur bodybuilding and figure contest, a competition open to anyone aged 13 and over with $40, a Speedo, and a healthy dose of chutzpah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience. We're going to start right out with the men's masters, 40 to 49 years old. Let's bring them out on stage. They'll hit a few shots, file off, and then the top three will come back and do their closing presentation.
Joseph Davis, a personal trainer from Arizona, is just one of four family members who made the 10-hour drive to compete today.
Muscle Beach, that's a place you go to because it has the nostalgia. You go and compete at Muscle Beach, to me, you're competing in history. This is where the heart of the whole situation is. This is where it started. This is where, if you were a bodybuilder back in the earlier days, you came here. Schwarzenegger was back here. Frank Zane was over here. You know, people came here. This is where they wanted to be.
Heck, in 1965, Joe Gold opened the first Gold's Gym just around the corner. The modern fitness movement can be traced back to this very spot where Muscle Beach started, in Venice, California. Or can it?
A lot of people today actually don't even know that Muscle Beach was originally in Santa Monica. They think it's just Venice was always the original place.
That's Marla Matzer-Rose, author of Muscle Beach, subtitled Where the Best Bodies in the World Started a Fitness Revolution. She claims that Muscle Beach actually started a few miles up the boardwalk in Santa Monica, long before my governor started pumping iron in Venice.
Venice Beach started informally as an area where people started congregating and lifting weights, and it always was more of a weightlifting and bodybuilding venue than Muscle Beach, which started as more an acrobatic venue.
Acrobats? On the beach?
It started sort of informally in the probably mid-1930s. A number of the people that started it were students at Santa Monica High School, which is still right down near the beach. The kids would go down there to work out. Actually, there was an earthquake in the 30s, and they didn't have a gym for a time, and that was apparently part of the reason why kids started going down there.
It didn't take long for word to spread about the great feats and bodies on display at Muscle Beach. At a reception for the Santa Monica Historical Society's current exhibit of Muscle Beach photographs, several Muscle Beach alumni are in attendance. I'm talking with DeForest Mosen, Relna Brewer McRae, and Glenn Sunby, a few of the original Santa Monica Muscle Beach acrobats. These three are some of the many athletes who'd perform and share stunts with literally anyone who happened to wander by.
Wow. Apparently you would have become an acrobat first time I seen you at the beach.
How would I become?
Bobby Yerkes came down one day. He says, I want to play table tennis. So I ran the place then.
Yeah.
I said, forget the table tennis. I'm going up on a platform and work out. I said, come with me.
Yeah.
And he became one of the greatest flyers in the country.
Huh. He was a catcher.
He was a catcher.
Let's just imagine we're back. It's 1938 or something like that. I go down to Muscle Beach. What would I see?
Well, on the platform, you'd see a few people working out, and you'd see fellas and swinging on the rings and high bar and the quad bars and a lot of pyramids. You see a lot of guys like Mo helping little kids learn how to do tricks. And
how many people would be in the audience? Could I get a seat?
In the summer, there'd be 10,000.
On weekends, there'd be thousands of people.
And it's easy to see why when you see these old photos. Abs of steel and chiseled jaws that would make a hardcore Atkins disciple green with envy. Did you eat well? Did you pay attention to, like, nutrition and stuff?
No, nobody thought about that in those days.
We ate what we could get.
Yeah, you only ate what you could get.
Isn't that the truth? We didn't take any drugs at all. We didn't even take aspirin, did we? Nothing. We felt so good that we'd go to bed and sleep good all night and get up and do the same thing the next day.
Mostly for fun. Nobody was professionals. I mean, we all just did it for fun.
That's right.
learning new tricks and meeting all our friends at the beach.
There's still major confusion to what caused Muscle Beach's demise. Some cite a scandal involving 5 weightlifters and 2 underage girls. Some say it just became too big, too fast. But at Venice Beach, you can still be surrounded by hundreds of half-naked bodies, painted bronze and glistening in the hot sun. Back at the Venice Classic, I'm speaking with Joanna Davis, the 16-year-old daughter of Joseph Davis, the personal trainer from Arizona. She's just finished competing in her first Venice Classic. What was going through your mind when you were out there?
To keep my stomach tight.
Did you have a hard time breathing? I can't imagine. If I keep my stomach tight, I don't think I could breathe. I think I would fall over.
Yes, it was hard breathing.
Yeah, and pretty hot out there, too?
Yeah, I thought I was going to pass out.
The new Muscle Beach bears little resemblance to the acrobats of old, according to Bobby Yerkes, one of the greatest catchers in the history of acrobatics.
Muscle Beach here, to me, was like a circus. Venice is like the freak show. So I don't know. It just, it's not the same at all. It's not like the old Muscle Beach was, where I wish we were back again. I'd love to see it come back with all the acrobats together and competition, helping each other out and everything. It was really great days then.
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Venice, California.
Okay, relax. Face the front and feet together. Give us a front lat spread. Hands, there you go. Terrific. Okay.
In Burnsville, Minnesota, construction has begun on a golf course atop a former garbage dump. The new project is designed to collect methane gas created by rotting garbage and generate electricity for the city, even as duffers above hook, slice, and generate gas of their own. As Mary Stuckey reported last summer, this dual-use project has created unique architectural challenges for the course's designer and for future golfers.
Enormous trucks lumber up a bumpy path and dump loads of household garbage. Birds swoop in for tidbits. This is the garbage dump for the city of Burnsville, Minnesota, a suburb south of St. Paul, and the site of a future golf course, which one waggish reporter referred to as Methane Meadows. It'll be built on top of garbage buried 100 feet deep. Gary Harker is director of recreation and facilities for the city of Burnsville. Harker admits a garbage dump golf course has raised some questions.
The public around here have never played on a landfill before. They're going to be doubting, you know, is it going to smell, what's it going to look like, and so on.
Harker claims there won't be a smell. The garbage will be well sealed and buried, covered with dirt and beautifully landscaped, offering gorgeous views of the Minnesota River Basin. Paul Miller is a golf course architect whose firm, Gil Miller, is designing the course.
Being up on top of the landfill is really quite dramatic. The views, taking advantage of that, coming down to the lower areas and using some of the wetlands and things along the river, I mean, it can be a very unique golf course.
One of the architect's biggest challenges is to build a golf course on top of an enormous mountain of garbage, which will settle and shift over time. For that reason, irrigation pipes must be made of flexible tubing, not stiff plastic, which could snap and break. The changing terrain will challenge golfers to the breaking point, too, says Burnsville's Gary Harker.
Hole number 7 could possibly play different this year than next year, so yes, it could bother your backswing.
Another challenge, the garbage won't support heavy buildings like a clubhouse, so it'll be built just off the course. Golfers will need to climb up a steep incline to the first tee, or perhaps ride on some sort of a tram. Once the Burnsville site becomes a working golf course, it will be one of only a handful in North America that also produce electricity. Garbage is sealed inside a heavy-duty flexible plastic, kind of like a super-duty garbage bag. As the garbage decomposes, bacteria generate methane gas, which gets trapped inside the plastic. A system of pipes sucks the gas out and sends it down the hill to a small generating plant, which turns the gas into electricity, enough to power 3,000 homes. Gary Harker says this improbable marriage between a recreational facility and a power source is already generating its fair share of humor.
All the jokes that have gone around about the potential of this golf course.
no smoking areas. You can just imagine the fun people would have naming this golf course. And there could be all kinds of goofy things.
Maplehurst or Oak Meadows are already out as naming possibilities because tree roots could puncture the plastic liner just 5 feet below the surface. But there will be shrubs and grasses, perhaps some shallow ponds, and a lot of challenging sand traps. Paul Miller says it'll be a long championship golf course.
There have been a lot of courses that link style where there weren't a lot of trees naturally. If people watch the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, a lot of the character of that golf course is through the longer grasses and really the, sort of the way that looks and that link style.
A golf course on a landfill that generates electricity might just be the future for more communities looking for open space on which to build courses. But it'll be a while before the folks in Burnsville know how their course works out, because it'll take as long as 15 years to fill up enough space for 18 holes, or just long enough for someone to come up with a name that sticks. For Only a Game, I'm Mary Stuckey in Burnsville, Minnesota.
We recently caught up with Gary Harker of the Burnsville Recreation Department, who says the project, though it is many years from completion, is progressing nicely. However, Harker admits they still haven't come up with a good name for the course. It's 18 minutes past the hour. In Long Beach, California, Santa swam with the sharks in the aquarium tank, hoping to get youngsters interested in the exhibit. In Portland, Maine, almost 200 Santas skied for charity. But the annual Jingle Bell Jump, during which Santa was supposed to parachute into the Anaheim Town Square Shopping Center, was sidetracked by federal regulations that prohibit planes from flying below 3,000 feet within 3 miles of Disneyland. A restriction, Disney officials say, protects the park from terrorist attack. No other theme parks have such protection. Asked for a comment, Santa would only say, ho, 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 ho.
Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a website devoted to American-style Olive Bowl. But first, there are those who think there is no better way to spend a Saturday afternoon or evening in the fall than to attend a big-time college football game. Then there are those who think there is no better way to spend a couple of days before the game than to hunker down in the parking lot, waiting. In order to write Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, Warren St. John spent the 2000 season with the rolling community of Alabama football fans who attend games in campers and recreational vehicles. Before the start of the 2004 college football season, Warren St. John joined Only a Game, and he told me that the best route into Alabama football was to join the weekly caravan of RVs occupied by Alabama's fans.
Well, as a kid, I grew up in Birmingham, and I always wandered through this vast maze of RVs outside the stadium. And it just, growing up there, it's something that you see so often, you fail to note how unusual it is. And I've lived in New York now for a number of years, and I would go back for games. And every time I saw it, and of course it's grown over the years, I was more and more taken by what an incredible phenomenon this was. And I felt that I needed to dive in myself and try to understand what was going on and why people would essentially drive their homes to a football stadium.
Alcohol plays a major part in the activities of the community that you came to know. That may be the understatement of the day with regard to this book, but to what extent are these folks just frat guys who never grew up?
There's certainly a wide range. I mean, there are a lot of families who go to these games, but it's definitely an indulgent atmosphere. And simply owning a $300,000 or $600,000 RV, one could argue, is an act of indulgence. These things get 4 or 5 miles per gallon. One thing I found about these hardcore fans is that they did pretty much everything in extremis. There was no moderation. This is not a group searching for the golden mean. These are people embracing embracing their urges.
All right. What made you decide that you had to have some sort of mobile home of your own?
The invitations to join other fans dried up after the second week. I managed to find a South Carolina couple who invited me along for the first weekend, and then a show chicken breeder from North Alabama who invited me along for the second. But after that, I was on my own, and so I quickly went through the classifieds of the Birmingham News and found a 1978 motorhome, a $5,500 RV, which you can imagine next to a $1.3 million RV, what $5,500 bucks gets you. It more or less worked. It got me most of the time where I was going, if not always on time. And it actually helped to build my cred with this community because they saw me on my back underneath my RV fixing things just as they were. So over time, I think it helped, and it certainly allowed me to really go deep in this culture.
Among your adventures when you were looking for a mobile home was an encounter with a gentleman who was very grumpy, and you didn't find out until later why that was.
Sure, that was when I was shopping for RVs, and this was a rather sullen individual, and we had a test drive together, and I was a little uncertain about why he was in such a foul mood, and he sort of later acknowledged that it was because his wife had mandated the sale of his RV. And he was so reluctantly put it in the paper. And I asked him if the generator worked. And of course, the generators on these things power the air conditioner and the refrigerators and everything else. So they're pretty vital, especially in the hot late summer and early fall of football season in the South. And it didn't work. And he was very frustrated by this, started rummaging around in the generator compartment with a giant screwdriver. And I heard a tremendous snap and a blue flash of light. And I saw him flying backwards as he got a jolt from the car battery that ran this thing. He quickly got up and dusted himself off and said, "Don't worry, I work for the power company," as if somehow this explained his ability to recover from a sudden jolt of electricity.
You write of the fans who inhabit parking lots together throughout the fall that their connections, the connections between them are, quote, as fleeting as they are intense. These folks don't have all that much to do with each other beyond the parking lots, I gather.
That's right. Many of them don't know each other's last names, actually. And there's this community that forms instantly at the beginning of football season. It's incredibly tight and intimate, especially when you're at an away stadium and you really feel like the world outside is hostile and people sort of bond together. But on Sunday morning, after the last game, people get in their RVs and then take off to their lives outside of football. And without this glue of fandom to hold them together, they quickly sort of blend back into the fabric of American culture, only to reconvene next season.
Warren, late in the book, you write, quote, "I've spent a month in Tuscaloosa. When I arrived, I didn't especially want to be there. Now I don't especially want to leave." Were you worried when you realized that you felt that way?
Well, part of the story of the book is about my getting drawn in. And I embarked on this with a sense of objectivity. I'm a reporter for The New York Times, and I dove into this world just the way any reporter would. But because I was a fan, I quickly found that it was impossible to be objective. And I tried to exploit that tension that I felt. And by the end of the season, of course, I'd gotten to know all the players. I knew all of their stories. I was totally immersed and therefore totally hooked. And what I found was that the more you know about the team, the more you can identify with the players, the harder it is to step back and not get completely drawn in.
Does the experience of spending so much time and such intense time around the team and its fans, has it changed the way that you're going to relate to Alabama football this season? Are you going to travel to watch the team? Are you going to be in Tuscaloosa? What's your plan?
I'm going to go to several games this season, but I think the process of the book and the goal of the book ultimately was try to find a way to be an enlightened fan, to see if there was some way to enjoy the process of totally giving yourself over to the fan experience without totally abandoning rationality. And so it's the process of reporting it and writing the book has definitely changed the way I feel about sports And it's made me more aware of what's happening emotionally to me as a game goes on. But it hasn't made me any less depressed over a loss or any less happy after a win. And therefore, I plan to be there in person as much as possible.
Warren St. John is the author of Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, published by Crown. He joined me from NPR's New York studios. Warren, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun.
Though he no longer rolls in the Tide caravan, Warren St. John still attends Alabama games on occasion, including the 2004 game with hated rival Auburn. Bama lost that game, but St. John and his Crimson Tide brethren did have the satisfaction of seeing the Tigers shut out of this year's national championship game. In his neat but cramped dormitory room at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Tien He is tapping away at his laptop computer. But the screen contains no commentary on differential equations, no argument refuting Einstein's theories regarding space and time. Tien He is writing about football, and he's writing in Chinese for an audience in China.
I purely went in because I was interested in football. I was interested in the opportunity that this presented, really to be able to introduce Chinese people to something that's fairly new to them. It's just awesome. And since I have that ability, you know, I thought, why not? Why not try it?
The opportunity to which Tien He refers came to him through a call for help from the Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. The team is owned by Robert Kraft, whose paper products businesses operate internationally and have connections in China. When Sun and Patriots vice chairman Jonathan Kraft wondered out loud why the team shouldn't have a website to fire up folks in Beijing about the Pats, Fred Kirsch, director of interactive media for the Patriots, placed the ad. Wanted, football fan fluent in Mandarin to establish website for potential market of billions.
Well, it was Jonathan's idea, so that's why it was accepted as a good idea. But seriously, I mean, he's always coming up with ideas and, you know, how to market the team and get the brand out there. And with all the other business stuff he does, the Asian market is something he's always in contact with. So it's just natural, I think, for him to have thought of it.
Of course, once Fred Kirsch thought he'd found his webmaster, he realized that he really couldn't tell whether Tien He was the real goods or a fraud or a prankster. MIT is, after all, famous for pulling stunts like causing a giant weather balloon to inflate at midfield during the halftime show of the Yale-Harvard football game in 1982. Kirsch realized he had a problem, or at least a challenge.
When Tien first started this, we had our people over there looking over his work just to make sure that, you know, it was up to snuff and it was okay, because I don't have any Chinese proofreaders here.
One presumes that the proofreaders Fred Kirsch found working for the Crafts in China will continue to monitor the new website. Without that sort of check, Tien He could be uploading, well, anything.
True.
I mean, how are they going to know?
So this could all be gibberish
right
now.
It could be. The Patriots are not worth rooting for. They are a foolish team made up of idiots and run by clowns.
Yeah, during the interview, what they actually did was they asked me to translate a couple of things. We also did a recording session where they asked me to basically read off a transcript that I had translated. I guess they asked some consultants from China about how my Chinese was. And I guess it was somewhat acceptable.
Even assuming Tien He's competence and his loyalty to the football team for which he works and roots, a certain amount of gibberish would seem to be inevitable, considering the challenge of translating the terminology of football into a language that's never before been applied to the distinctly American game, which is known in China, if it's known at all, as American-style olive ball, because the football looks somewhat like a Chinese olive. Then there's the matter of the positions.
So right here, for example, right, quarterback, quarter is a fourth, right?
Yeah.
These are three characters, 四分位. 四分 is like to split in four. So that's where the quarter part is. And 位 is kind of like a position. So basically it's saying a position of dividing into four.
It's not possible to judge how successfully Tien He is communicating to his homeland the exciting adventures of Tom Brady, legendary two-time Super Bowl champion who plays the position that is divided into four. The Patriots' Chinese website lacks a link that would enable folks in China to respond to He's articles, but that's coming. And Fred Kirsch of the Patriots says he hopes marketing is coming too.
Absolutely. That's the game plan. You know, why not have the Patriots be the first team that everyone, you know, starts following there? Because eventually, you know, you're going to keep some of those fans. And, you know, Tien was a Patriots fan because that was the first game he saw. And I think those first impressions are lasting ones, especially in sports.
Given that selling stuff is the acknowledged aim of the Pats, I asked webmaster He, who was reluctant to disclose how much the Patriots are paying him to maintain their Chinese website, what would happen if the first 3,000 responses that he ultimately gets from China are all orders for facsimile Pats jerseys?
Well, maybe then we'll have to talk to Mr. Kraft about some new opportunities in marketing there.
Tien He himself began learning about football when his family left Beijing and moved to Tennessee when Tien was 10 years old. Later, he lived in Atlanta, but because the New England Patriots were the underdog in the first NFL game that he saw, he became a fan of the Pats rather than the Atlanta Falcons. Whether the process by which he became a fan will turn out to be replicable via cyberspace remains to be seen. But Dr. Stephen Lewis, the director of Asian Studies at Rice University in Houston, says the outreach program undertaken by the Patriots and the National Football League may not be in vain.
I think it does have possibilities. In Chinese cities, with young men in particular, there's this a new kind of, you know, identification with other young people in particular in other cities. They like to think of themselves as doing all the things that other, you know, young people do in these other cities, and that includes things like, you know, more Western hip-hop music or, you know, watching films, you know, or sports. And here, I think, in a way, they, you know, whether this is intentional or not, the NFL can be kind of riding the coattails of the NBA.
In China, the NBA is Houston Rockets center Yao Ming. Football has no such local lad made good upon whom to hang its marketing efforts, but according to Fred Kirsch, there's more than one way to sell a replica jersey.
I know in 2006, and I might be letting the cat out of the bag here, I don't know, but I can guarantee you that there will be an NFL game played on mainland China in 2006. I don't know who will be playing it, but there will be two teams playing football in 2006 at mainland China. So this is going forward, and I think Jonathan was right in his assumption that we better get on board.
MIT junior Tien He, one of the most junior part-time employees of the Kraft family, would no doubt agree. And as a benefit, members of Tien's family, to whom he sends all his web articles, assure him that his Chinese is getting better all the time. Since we aired this story last month, the Oakland Raiders started their own Chinese and German web pages. Of course, given the team's fan base, one wonders how you say silver-painted drunken fan wearing chainmail in Mandarin. On the night before Christmas, there doubtless were games, and on Christmas as well, we behold all the names, not of Dasher and Dancer and Rudolph and Blitzen, but of each guy who scores, and of each guy who sits in a whirlpool to undo the knots in his back, because sports never stops, and there's never a lack of the running and tackling and throwing and shooting that leads to the wildly obstreperous rooting of people who live for the games that they see in the flesh, if they can, or if not, on TV. There's basketball, football, and hockey, unless there's a lockout. There is, though I have to confess that I've almost not missed it with all of the news of the old boys of summer inclined to abuse all the oils and potions enhancing their power. And then there's the matter from hour to hour of where the free agents will next sign to play. Oh, the updates are constant. They don't go away just because it's the season for family and giving. Even now, call the agents, all making a living. But now, for a moment, since Christmas has come, we might try to recall where the gifts have been from that have brightened our seasons, no matter the sport. the grace of the hitter, the stunning report of the crack of the bat as the ball disappears in a colorful muddle of roaring and cheers, the arc of a shot at the buzzer's last sound and the crowd's frozen moment, the ball coming down, then it drops through the net to record the last point in a game so terrific it lights up the joint, and the people departing the places they sat shouting, "I can't believe it, man! Did you see that?" These are gifts that can lift us to glimpse for a time how great talent and work can produce the sublime. May your winter be studded by moments that show you the happiest elegance sports fans can know. May all of us see, despite hype, pomp, and fame, that the fun of that art is it's only a game. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implant, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Brazilian soccer legend fights for survival. But first, Clay Travis is an attorney working and living in the U.S. Virgin Islands. He's also a fan of the NFL's Tennessee Titans. Alas, Titans games were not available to television viewers on the island Paradise. So at 9:32 a.m. on September 13th, Travis started his own unique protest in hopes of changing this intolerable situation. Clay Travis appeared on Only a Game in October, and I asked him if he could explain his protest.
Yes, I can. I would describe it as an absurd and ridiculous strike in response to an absurd and ridiculous policy. The U.S. Virgin Islands doesn't have the opportunity to get DirecTV. For whatever reason, DirecTV doesn't provide access to the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't get the NFL Sunday ticket, which means about 20 games a week aren't available anywhere on the island, not in sports bars, not in your own home, anywhere. So mm-hmm. I thought that was absurd and ridiculous, and so I've started upon an absurd and ridiculous strike.
And might you describe the strike?
Yes, it's a pudding-only diet.
Ah.
I eat pudding and fluids. So until the NFL remedies the situation, I thought, people ask, you know, why did I choose pudding? It's an absurd and ridiculous food. It doesn't need to be refrigerated, and it's hard to say pudding with a straight face in my experience.
Well, how many puddings do you consume in a day, and what's on today's menu?
It varies. It's been anywhere from 6 to 9, depending on whether it's the weekend and I manage to get up in time for breakfast. So it's been over 200 and a third. I couldn't finish tapioca. It's a horrible flavor, in my opinion. And I've got pudding reviews on the website. My favorite is vanilla, and on the menu today is vanilla and chocolate, actually. And I think I'm going to go out and buy – I've got to get some new supplies, so I'm hoping there's going to be, you know, more of a difference in stock in the grocery stores down here.
Well, I've read your letter to NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue beseeching him to allocate a small portion of the NFL's $2.2 billion annual TV revenue to fund the technology which would bring NFL games to the Virgin Islands. Has he responded to you?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, the media has put some pressure on both he and DirecTV, and I think they've had some responses to the media, but they, for whatever reason, they're stonewalling me. I talk about how they're dodging me quite a bit in my pudding diaries. They won't talk to me. So, you know, people ask me, am I enjoying the attention? No, I'd much rather would enjoy solid foods. You know, I would end this tomorrow if they would just bring the games to the island. But for whatever reason, they're just refusing to, you know, hoping that I don't exist. And that's why, you know, the media attention is starting to help out, I think.
So the media may help you. Will the actual pudding strike help, or is it the fact that you can't say it with a straight face? Maybe nobody else can take it seriously either.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a tongue-in-cheek strike, clearly. I mean, the website itself is pretty funny. It's intended to bring levity to the day and, you know, entertain people. But also, I mean, it's pointing out a serious fact. I mean, there's 108,000 people in the U.S. Virgin Islands. You know, it's the National Football League. Why DirecTV doesn't come there, or why they can't issue a response, or why the NFL can't issue a response, I mean, you know, is patently absurd as well. You know, I mean, they're multi-billion-dollar corporations. And like you said, you know, they made over $2 billion in television revenue, the NFL did. How much money would it cost them to bring the games to the island? A few thousand dollars? I mean, really nothing at all. It's a pittance.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you're a lawyer. I'm guessing you have hundreds in the bank. Why not just fly to Titans games each weekend?
Well, I've also got $75,000 in student loans thanks to Vanderbilt Law School. So that's not conducive to the jaunting about the globe sort of lifestyle. I work. I'm gainfully employed as an attorney. So I can't. The flight schedules don't really work that well for me to be running around and seeing games.
Do you suppose Vanderbilt is proud that you've mentioned it, or do you suppose the people at Vanderbilt Law School are now, hitting their heads with the palms of their hands, wishing you hadn't mentioned Vanderbilt at all?
Somebody from the admission staff probably just got fired. No, I think that I've actually gotten several emails from the people at Vanderbilt Law School. They have pretty good senses of humor. But a lot of the people who are contributing to the site are lawyers, so I don't have to worry that much. People have been asking me, am I worried about getting sued, which is funny. No, one, I think if the NFL or DirecTV sues me, it just adds another ridiculous level of irony to this whole thing.
How long do you think you can continue the pudding strike?
Boy, I hope not much longer. I hope I'm not going to have to, because all along, this ball has been in the NFL. The football has been in the NFL and DirecTV's field. They can make a play and end this whole thing, to continue a strained metaphor there. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I'm hoping that it's going to end soon. And like I say, I'm keeping my pudding close to my vest. I don't want to give them a date because I think they'll just wait me out. So hopefully with all the media attention and you guys sort of working as intermediaries, since they won't speak to me, eventually we're going to get some sort of situation remedied here.
Clay Travis follows his Tennessee Titans from the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he also maintains NFLPuddingStrike.com. Clay, thank you for joining me, and I share your hope that you can end the pudding strike very, very soon.
Thank you very much, and my wife shares your hope as well. She wants to go out to dinner.
Sporting time. It's sporting time, children.
Clay Travis ended his strike not long after our interview. After eating over 360 puddings, not only had Travis made his point, he'd also found a way to watch his beloved Titans via a pirated boat feed from Trinidad. No word on whether Travis took his wife out to dinner when it was all over. Let's hope for his sake that he did. Bulldoze Yankee Stadium. Replace Lambeau Field. Demolish Wrigley Field. At least one of those exhortations is bound to horrify various American sports fans. So imagine what it was like for Brazilian soccer fans when one group raised the brazen cry, Destroy Maracanã. Last summer, Only a Game's Ken Shulman visited the legendary stadium and returned with this report.
Six 600 pilgrims arrive at Maracanã Stadium every day. Some genuflect before the bronze footprints of Brazil's soccer demigods.
Garrincha played for Botafogo from Rio, and some people say he was better than Pelé. But he used to drink too much.
Others pause before glass cases housing Maracanã's relics. Rivelino's faded, threadbare jersey. Garrincha's crumbling soccer boots. The scuffed, deflated ball that Pelé drilled into the fabled stadium's southern net in 1969 for his 1,000th career goal. Ecstatic visitors jog through the stadium tunnel, past life-size poster icons from Brazil's unprecedented 5 World Cup triumphs, and then, accompanied by flashing lights and recorded sounds from Maracanã's heyday in the 1950s and 60s, sprint up the dozen cement stairs and onto soccer's most hallowed playing field. But future generations may never hear these sounds. 2 years ago, as part of his effort to help Brazil land the 2014 World Cup, Brazilian Soccer Federation President Ricardo Teixeira proposed the unthinkable, to raise Maracanã and build a smaller, more modern stadium in its place. The proposal left most of Brazil speechless, but not all.
Hoje na França não precisaram de derrubar.
Dalva Lazzaroni is a Rio-based writer and cultural activist. Her nephew, Sebastião Lazzaroni, coached the Brazilian national team at the 1990 World Cup in Italy. This past June, Lazzaroni organized O Maracá e Nossa, an activist group dedicated to preserving Maracanã. To date, the group has over 50,000 members. Yes, Lazzaroni concedes, some structures do outlive their usefulness. Even England's mythical Wembley Stadium was demolished in 2003. But Maracanã, she says, is different.
Por exemplo, o Wembley não foi lá que jogou o Garrincha. Pelé.
Garrincha didn't play at Wembley, Pelé didn't play at Wembley, nor did Nilton Santos, Rivelino, or Zico, or Romário. Maracanã is part of our lives. Of course it needs to be modernized. Of course it needs parking. But it must not be destroyed. It would be like asking an American to watch the destruction of the Statue of Liberty.
As a Carioca, a native of Rio, Lazzaroni acknowledges her special bond with Maracanã. But her crusade, she says, is anything but provincial.
Não é para os cariocas, é para a humanidade.
We're not just doing it for the people of Rio or even the people of Brazil. We're doing it for all of humanity, because Maracanã belongs to all of mankind. For 12 years during the Second World War, there was no World Cup. And after the war ended, the world sank into a deep depression. So many deaths, so many assassinations, an atrocity of such an inconceivable scale. And to help heal the world, they decided to hold a tournament. A tournament that would lift the spirits of the people and include all the countries of the world. And they chose Brazil, and Brazil built Maracanã. This stadium was sparked by the thought of bringing together humanity.
If the 1950 World Cup helped the nations of World War II redeem their tragic past, it also permitted Brazil to stake an ambitious claim on the future. The largest country in South America, Brazil had recently emerged from a 16-year military dictatorship and was moving towards civilian rule. The Brazilian economy was shifting into high gear with booms in construction, agriculture, and industry. 1950 was also when Rio began to assume its present footprint and silhouette. Rural migrants flocked to Brazil's capital to man its new industrial plant. When Brazil was chosen to host the 1950 World Cup, the Brazilians decided to wow the world with a stadium unlike any other.
It became a symbol of the technological capacity of the nation because it was the biggest football stadium of the world at that time.
Paulo Knaus is professor of urban studies and history at the Federal Fluminense University in Rio. He says that Maracanã was built as a symbol of Brazilian pride and unity.
It was really a matter of a national identity, building it and improving football culture in the city and also promoting this national spirit that Brazilians can do things when they come together. But nowadays, it's already an old-fashioned symbol. So there's a real discussion about the stadium because in nowadays, it can't express anymore this modernity of the Brazilian engineering.
Construction on Maracanã Stadium began in April 1948 and was completed after 22 months. The project required 500,000 bags of cement, 10,000 tons of steel, and 7.7 million man-hours. Upon completion, the 1.7 million square foot oval stadium was the largest and most modern venue in all of soccer. Named for a nearby river, Maracanã still holds the records for the most spectators to attend a soccer match. The 199,854 fans who watched Brazil give up two last-minute goals to lose 2-1 to Uruguay in the final match of the 1950 World Cup. Perhaps the failure of the Seleção, the Brazilian national team, to consecrate Maracanã with a World Cup triumph was an omen, at least for the country. After a rapid period of expansion in the 1950s, Brazil's economy contracted towards the end of the decade. Brazil's experiment with democracy was equally spasmodic and ended with a military takeover in 1964.
The 50s were an era of optimism in Brazil. People always had the sensation that the future would be better.
Alfredo Sirkis is Secretary of Urban Management for the city of Rio de Janeiro. It's a challenging job here in this city, where an estimated 40% of all dwellings were built outside of municipal regulations, and where one in every six inhabitants lives in Rio's favelas, the slums or shanty towns that blanket the hills above the city.
No, I think that the sensation people have is they're afraid of the future. In the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and even the 80s, at the time of the the transition between the dictatorship and democracy, people thought that the future would be better than the present. I think now people are afraid that the future will be worse than the present.
While the Selección recovered from its 1950 defeat to post a record 5 World Cup victories, Brazil continued and continues to struggle with corruption, crime, and social injustice. According to a 2003 World Bank report, 25% of Brazilians live below the poverty line. Rio's topography reads like an X-ray of the country's inequalities, with favelas set like patches of blight above and even adjacent to healthy, high-rent districts like Ipanema and Leblon. Maracanã, once the proud symbol of Brazil's brave new world, now slouches, blanched and brittle, like a skeleton of a future that never was. While structurally sound, the massive stadium has serious shortcomings. There are only 2 entrances and exits, making a rapid evacuation both problematic and dangerous. There are no security barriers to channel and divide rival fan groups, which have grown increasingly violent. Parking around the stadium is almost non-existent. And yet, despite its decline, Maracanã continues to inspire. Young players all across the country still dream of racing out of the stadium tunnel and of celebrating their first goal at Maracanã with a sprint beneath the far curb. Tourists still flock to the stadium and soccer museum. And Maracanã has plenty of defenders, including Francisco de Carvalho, Secretary of Sport for the state of Rio de Janeiro, which owns Maracanã. Born in 1950, the same year Maracanã was completed, de Carvalho has already secured $30 million to help bring the stadium into the 21st century with adequate parking, security, and access.
This is the most beautiful stadium in the world. There's nothing else like it in the world. In the past, it was treated badly. Now we're beginning to treat it well. And as long as I'm alive, I'm going to fight to preserve it and to make it better.
I think Ricardo Teixeira is an imbecile.
José Peruano is director of all fan clubs for Flamengo, Brazil's most popular professional team. Flamengo claims to have 30 million fans across Brazil. Peruano is violently opposed to any proposal to destroy Maracanã. Yes, he says, the English demolished Wembley, but the English are a rational and practical people. The Brazilians have a different culture and spirit.
He wants to demolish the stadium like they do in Europe. But this isn't Europe. This is Latin America. This is Brazil. Brazil is a nation that suffers, where people have to struggle to survive. With horrible salaries and inflation and uncertainty, we have a very difficult life. The only joy we have is soccer. Soccer is everything for Brazilians. If there was no soccer, there would be no joy. And when our soccer team is going well, we are able to overcome our difficulties. We feel like we can fight. We can't lose Maracanã. It would be like losing the statue of Christ the Redeemer on Corcovado above the city. Maracanã is the pulse of Rio de Janeiro.
Maracanã may still be the pulse of Brazil's former capital, but that pulse is weakening. The crowds of 100, 150, even 200,000 that once packed the world's biggest stadium are now a fading echo. These days, even Flamengo rarely draws over 30,000 to its home matches at Maracanã. At this match, against crosstown rival Vasco da Gama, the paid attendance is barely 18,000. Soccer is still an act of faith in Brazil. Faith seems strong enough to save the world. Today, it may not even be strong enough to save Maracanã. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Keith Shields and from Ted O'Brien. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Sir Lionel Barrymore in the role of Ebenezer Scrooge.
Christmas.
Ah, yeah, but remember, it turned out just fine for him as well. Merry Christmas, happy holidays. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.